From the Paley Center for Media in New York, this is Max Media. Here's Max Robbins.
Hello, everybody. I'm here today with Mr. Peter Hamilton. For those of you who don't know, and I'm sure several of you listening do know, Peter is the founder of DocumentaryTelevision.com. Quite frankly, this is probably the smartest guy there is about the whole business of non-scripted, unscripted television. Peter, we should talk about that later. We got to come up with the right word. There's so many phrases to describe this. But he's a veteran. He's worked at CBS. He's worked for a lot of the biggest networks, Discovery, whatnot. He's really been inside this business like few others have. And we are extremely happy to have him with us today. Peter Hamilton, welcome.
Thank you very much, Max.
So, just tell me a little bit. You know, a lot of what we try and do here is talk about how people really get inside what they do and all these different facets of the media business. And you certainly are all about documentary television. Give us a little, like, snapshot of the arc of your career, how you got to where you are today into DocumentaryTelevision.com.
Right. Thanks, Max. Well, I worked for CBS for several years in business development and along with about two floors of people got fired one day. And I realized that the future lay at that time, which was in the mid-1980s, that the future lay in business development in the cable and satellite area, which was just emerging and which the network folks didn't really see on their radar. And my first client, God bless them, was Discovery Communications, who at that time had maybe 30 employees in a back office in Landover. And then I really got the vision thing that this was coming. And I always loved documentaries. I loved factual television and news. And I decided to hang my hat on that area, on business development for networks that had a high level of commitment to either documentaries or some kind of news and information.
It must have been so exciting at Discovery at that day. I mean, it must have been just walk in the office, come up with an idea, and let's just try it.
Well, the hardest thing was waiting to get paid, of course. That's the downside of exciting. but, you know what? It was a fraught time because they, frankly, didn't know whether they were going to make it for many years. It's hard to imagine this. There were 30 employees here. They had trouble there. They had trouble making their payroll. And it wasn't until they solidified their relationship with John Malone and TCI, as it was at the time, that the path became clear for them. And that was the transition period. But the most exciting thing about it was that I used to go to MIP, the big TV market, with them.
And in Cannes.
In Cannes.
Yeah, that's tough. That's tough duty there. Over in the Riviera.
it was really painful. But that's where television was bought and sold. And what you'd have is these 27, 28-year-old graduates from the University of Maryland wandering up and down the aisles of Cannes and finding entire genres of programs that nobody thought existed. And I'd meet with them and they'd come back and they'd say, guess what? I found this distributor who's got hours and hours and hours of military stuff about blowing up tanks. And can you imagine that? And everyone would say, really? And then the next day or the next week, there'd be a whole military genre on Discovery. And the other thing is that A&E were doing the same thing at the same time. And so they were competing with each other to find these genres that have since come to define the factual area. And it was really, truly an amazing and wonderful moment in history.
That's great. It was there some sort of moment, like maybe you're at an international market or just that kind of oh, wow market, and you say, wow, this is going to go. There's an appetite here. There's something really happening here, and I'm riding a wave.
Well, I think the first thing is when you see an asterisk give away to a point in the ratings, and that happened in the mid-80s, and that's an incredible bellwether when a network like A&E rounds off to a 0.01.
They exist.
They exist. And they're not going away. And then the other incredible experience we had was that myself and my colleague John DiGiacomo were engaged to help Discovery build their home video business as a direct response business because they had so much unsold inventory. We said, why don't you get the rights for the programs that you are screening and then offer them as a collectible video package to your viewers and to put up a persuasive direct response spot that portrayed the benefits of the program. And Discovery reluctantly agreed to this. And we looked at their schedule and we couldn't see anything upcoming that was really appealing to the audience. There was just nothing that really nailed it. And we didn't want to go start off with a failure. So then we said to them, well, what's about to be repeated on its second run? And they showed us a list, and the second film on the list was a multi-part series from ZDF in Germany, the esteemed German public television station, called Hitler, The Whole Story. And we said, let's offer that in DVD. And we did, and we sold hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of this documentary on the Second World War through the biography of Hitler. And that just showed us that there was an incredible number of people watching this stuff, valuing it, and wanting to pay for it and collect it. And that ran across the Discovery genres. And that was a real turning point for us.
Man, it's, and then you fast forward to now. Look at this incredible suite of networks that Discovery has with TLC, all the spins on Discovery. It's pretty amazing and shows that sometimes outpace broadcast networks.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever think you'd live that long?
I did. I mean, we understood from the get-go that multi-channel television, because it had two revenue streams, advertising and subscription revenues, was ultimately more viable than broadcast. And that at some stage in the future, and we had no idea when, that the cable and satellite distributed channels would be more profitable, number one, because of the two revenue streams, and have bigger audiences, number two, than the broadcast network.
You're listening to Max Media from the Paley Center, and I'm here today with Peter Hamilton of DocumentaryTelevision.com. It's amazing. I mean, if we look now, we knew you were coming in today, and we were laughing about it last night. The number one show last week, a factual show, Jersey Shore.
Right. Well, it really stretches the definition of factual. And people say to me, you know, how can you bear to write about this stuff on DocumentaryTelevision.com? Well, it so happened last night I watched Cake Box. Which is also, sorry, Cake Boss. I'm sorry. I watch Cake Boss, as I've come to watch every week. And that is a really beautiful kind of personality-driven, observational documentary series, if you wish.
And a major hit on TLC.
A major hit on TLC, and it's really good-hearted, and you finish it, and you feel good about your life. So everybody that you know, the media and all content has a vast spectrum, you know, from the horrible and violent to the weird and wonderful, as I would categorize Jersey Shore, you know, to the actual, you know, inspirational to me anyway, since I love baking and love Italian personalities, Cake Boss.
Well, that also brings us to something you decided to do. You had a thriving consulting business. You're working for a number of major cable networks. Boom. Last February, if I'm not mistaken, you own the URL documentarytelevision.com.
Correct.
And A, how did you happen to license that? B, what made you take this plunge?
Well, first of all, I licensed documentarytelevision.com in the 90s, and I was invited to participate with one of the dot-com boom companies in establishing some kind of business around documentarytelevision.com, and they were going to put millions of dollars into this. And I took a hard look at it, and I realized that it was going to change my life in a really bad way, that I was going to be owned by these investors, that they were going to be driving me, and that I just didn't have faith in the business model that we were proposing. And that was the best best decision I ever made. You know, it's a slight digression, but I worked for many years as a consultant to Landmark Communications, which owned the Weather Channel. And Frank Batten was the, you know, enormously wealthy and incredibly smart gentleman who owned Landmark Communications. And he had had a throat cancer. And he said to me one day when I proposed a deal, he said, Peter, I never lost any money on a deal I didn't do. And that always stayed with me. You know, to be really careful before you commit yourself on some deal because you can lose more than money. So I had the URL, and I started my life as a journalist. I always wanted to be a journalist. And I was also, because I do lots of presentations at these international factual and documentary and television and other conferences, I've always talked about the underlying economics and numbers in the business. That's always been what interests me, like how the business works and what people are earning, what they're paying, and all of these kinds of issues. And I have people line up after my presentations and after the panels where I'm with colleagues, giving me their cards, saying, please send me the presentation. I've never heard this before. Now, why have they never heard this before? To me, it's because the factual and documentary TV industry kind of grew out of a culture at the BBC and PBS and a couple of places like that, where a gentleman from Oxford would have a chat with a lady from Yale, and they do a deal about co-producing or commissioning a documentary series, and the money just wasn't really something that one talked about.
That would be unseemly.
I don't know whether it was unseemly or just irrelevant.
But what you did when DocumentaryTelevision.com launched, I mean, I got to say, I mean, I've covered this business for more than two decades, and I see this thing, shows up in my inbox, and I go, Peter Hamilton, you're giving away the secret sauce, man. You're giving it away for free. You're saying, you're pulling back the curtain. It's amazing. You're saying, here, A&E, this is what they pay. History Channel, this is what they're going to pay you. MTV, this is what they're going to pay you. I mean, I got to think you got some angry phone calls.
I didn't get any angry phone calls. I probably got a couple of people didn't answer my phone calls and a couple of raised eyebrows, but I've actually been flooded with subscribers, which is no big deal because they're free. But, you know, in this environment, to elect to receive information is actually a big statement. So my circulation has grown fast. My readership has grown fast. My pages viewed. I had a record this week because our story was about the preferred vendor system. Why do networks prefer to concentrate their commissions on a handful of preferred, established producers? Why don't they take more risks and spread the commissions over a wider community? I broke my record this week, and I thought that was pretty cool for the second or third week of a hot summer or whatever it is.
Can you share the number with us, or are you going to keep that to yourself?
In that case, there's no kind of number, but the reason why any business prefers to work with a small list of suppliers or vendors, whether it's Walmart and umbrella suppliers or Discovery and program suppliers, is that if you concentrate your supply chain, it's more efficient. You deal with fewer lawyers, fewer outside consultants, you know, fewer technical people. Your relationships are concentrated, and that leads to efficiency. The downside of that, of course, is that your preferred vendors want a premium, particularly if they're successful.
You're listening to Max Media. I'm here today with Peter Hamilton of DocumentaryTelevision.com. Is there some kind of a curve there? Is there a point of inflection where you're actually, if you stay with a preferred vendor, you're one of the big factual buyers of factual television,
right?
You're a History Channel or an A&E or one of the Discovery networks. Is it really more efficient in the end if you have to pay that premium?
Yeah, it's definitely reaches a trade-off. And I had a really good, interesting conversation with a development executive at a factual network last week. And he said to me that he's working closely with a production company in New York who he is nurturing to be the next, now I'm not going to name them, but this is one of the big suppliers to who supplies not only that network, but several other networks. So the channels are constantly relying on the efficiency model, but also not wanting to give their preferred vendors too much leverage or to have their product look the same as everybody else's. So at the same time, they're nurturing up-and-comers, and it's a balancing act.
Is there room, I mean, as the business models change, is there room, can those independent producers who I think are probably waiting every week for your what you're going to tell them about who they're going to be pitching to in their inboxes, can they make a living? Can they break in? Can you get into it? Has it gotten harder?
Well, it's definitely got harder. It's a mature business, the channels business. Channels are competing with each other for probably a stable amount of viewing or leisure time against all the other media that are available to kids today. And in a mature business, profitability is often achieved by squeezing the suppliers. And the suppliers are producers. It's a harsh way of categorizing the situation, but that's really the truth of it.
Well, you talk about there being this sweet spot, and how really, in a way, you're giving a blueprint to producers if they're looking to pitch, how they do that and do that successfully. You want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I think it's really, really fascinating. To me, when I went into documentarytelevision.com, it impressed me that, like, everybody knows what the underlying cost of, I don't know, Texas sweet crude or what it costs to make a Datsun or a Toyota
smartphone.
A smartphone. I mean, everybody knows the underlying costs. It's out there. And as I said, the business model for us was based on this tiny little artistic niche that is now a multi-billion dollar industry.
Really?
And so I've lost the track of your question.
Well, that's fine. What I'm wondering is like with this sweet spot.
Yeah, sweet spot, right.
Talk about a little bit about how, you know, in a sense, what your worth is, what your fear mark. I've come up with a great idea for a reality show.
Right.
Not that that's happening anytime soon. But I'm an experienced producer, but I'm going in there to pitch a new network. How do I know? What's documentarytelevision.com gonna tell me about how I do that, about what that sweet spot is?
All right. So every network has a programming budget that funds its schedule. And I find it useful to categorize that in, let's say, four ways that there are signature programs. And these are the annual or quarterly promotions that are supposed to be huge blockbusters that are just heavily promoted in all the media and define often the brand of the channel. And if you think of the old Discovery classics, you know, Walking with Dinosaurs, you know, multi-billion dollar per hour programs. The History Channel just did America, the Story of Us.
Right.
And the budget for that was probably $1.3 million an hour, full of CGI and expensive dramatic reenactments. That's your signature program. And, you know, your average, only a handful of producers are going to ever qualify for those kinds of projects, the BBC or somebody that's been at that very, very high level.
Some big international co-production where everybody's going to throw in.
Yeah, often a big international, nearly always a big international co-production. Then the next level is just high. What are networks going to pay for, let's say, a Sunday night primetime show? And then the next price point I call is the sweet spot. You know, what do they want to pay? What would they like to pay for an hour or a half hour? What's not going to ask any questions when you present this to the boss? What's going to not get you fired when you take this project forward? You know, what it's also benchmarked against what do other networks pay for the same kind of product? Because the commissioning editors are all changing jobs. Many of them have worked for networks themselves. They all know how much it costs to produce a Jersey Shore type project. So the sweet spot is the spot that everybody feels comfortable for, you know, know, a non-high, non-signature program. And then, of course, everybody's looking for a bargain, so you get a sense of what the networks are prepared to pay at the lower end. So I categorize the prices for the networks that they're prepared to pay for programs at those three or four levels. And it's really helpful because if you're a producer and you walk into a meeting and you're not on one of those points and you don't understand you're at one of those points, you're going to be lost. You know, you really need to go into a negotiation knowing what the channel are prepared to pay.
I'm just going to rattle off some figures that come from your site. I mean, A&E, for example, the sweet spot there, about $325,000 an episode. Discovery, about the same. History Channel, a little bit lower, $300,000. At the high end of that, $425,000. TLC, sweet spot, a little bit lower, $250,000. The high of that, $375,000. This is Max Media. We're here with Peter Hamilton, DocumentaryTelevision.com. Can producers make a living with at those rates?
Well, it's a really good question because I actually think, just as I divide the universe of programs into levels and categories, you need to apply the same kind of research framework, if you wish, to producers. And I see producers operating at, let's start with three levels. The first level is in your basement in Carroll Gardens or Cambridge MA or somewhere where you've got your editing suite and you get a commission for a single episode, a special or a feature from a HBO or from Nat Geo or somebody like that.
You're one of the people like the Sheilyn Evans, the goddess of documentary, right, at HBO, anoints you as one of the chosen few.
And, you know, obviously I have enormous respect for Sheilyn Evans, and it would be anybody's honor to be anointed by the HBO documentary team. So that's one option. There's Nat Geo, Discovery. Others anoint these one-offs or limited series. Nat Geo Television, which is a huge supplier to Nat Geo Channel, also commissions, you know, well over 100 hours a year. And some of them they do internally, but many of them they subcontract. Now, all of these commissioning editors run the budgets very, very tightly. And it's nonetheless possible, if you get the right sequence of projects, if you're steadily employed, if you own your own equipment, even better if you're not paying any rent, you can make a decent living out of this. But there's a whole series of qualifications there, and the most important one is repeat business. Now, the next level up I call, you know, a few mates in an office in some, you know, back part of town that get series. I get a series or two. It's a fraught kind of existence, let me tell you, because you're struggling from commission to commission and you have to eat a lot of your development costs because networks do not pay for the pitching and promotional costs. Now, the next level up, I would call it a $10 million to $12 million a year in commissions. And that is a producer who has enough scale to hire a full-time development person, a development assistant, a chief financial officer type person, a legal and business affairs advisor who is on the road, you know, pitching constantly, attends and takes stands at the big conferences and so on. And at that $10 and $12 million business, you can make a nice living, but not the same living as if you were inside the network with the same, you know, range of responsibilities. You've got your independence, you might have your name on the door, but you still don't have all the benefits of employment inside a network. And it's important to know that most network commissions, or nearly all, are works for hire. Very few producers retain any rights at all.
So the networks know they've got the leverage, and they're gonna own as much as they can of that back end, and
no, all of it, with exceptions.
That's tough. Yeah.
So there's one level above that, and that's the network that's doing $20 or $25 million a year. And we can think of two or three of them, like Original Productions. Tom Beer's company is a classic example. And they have reached a scale where they're such players that they get bought out by a Fremantle or one of the big international players.
An Endemol or something.
Endemol, yeah. They're the Fremantle and Endemol are the two big players, or two of the big players, that to reach that level is the dream for the producers in that kind of, you know, intermediate and high level, to be actually, to have reached the scale where they get bought out and all their hard work is turned into equity.
But there are very few of them. To a house in Malibu and a Range Rover in the driveway.
There you go.
We don't have a lot more time, but I did want to talk to you about what all these new platforms mean for the documentary business. I know you've written about it, but what ultimately distribution via the web means, what 3D is going to mean, what mobile is going to mean. I mean, it's a lot of ground to cover, but maybe one by one. Let's talk a little bit about the web and what that does to this whole world of the independent producer who's trying to make quality factual television and be in the marketplace.
Well, you know, as the publisher of documentarytelevision.com, I can tell you that a lot of work goes into distributing any kind of content on the web, but it's, you know, digital pennies for, you know, versus analog dollars. So clearly the web creates tremendous opportunities for, you know, supplementary distribution of existing programs. And that's very attractive, and the various platforms we needn't discuss now. But I don't see any hope in digital distribution for a project that's not already funded by a network or a foundation or some other kind of unique funding arrangement. You mentioned 3D. I think 3D is coming, and it's coming faster than we all recognize. And it's and in my genre, the area where it really seems to click, where people love it, is natural history. And I'm looking forward to some amazing wildlife films that will just change our way of looking at wildlife. I see 3D growing very fast. They're the two main areas you mentioned.
But the 3D really adds a cost, too, for producers and for the networks. I mean, I was recently in a mall in Boston, and there was a Sony store there. And they had a incredible display, an aquatic film in 3D. And, boy, it really did make you want to reach into your pocket and upgrade from your current flat HDTV to a 3D machine. You said quicker than we think. How far away are we looking here?
Well, you know, I'm really not an expert in distribution platforms, but I've been tracking sales, and I've been tracking adoption, I've been tracking experimentation, the level of interest by networks, and so on. So I think, you know, it's going to take several years, but I just read yesterday that 3D was rolling out on a similar pace to HD, which, you know, really surprised me on one level. On another level, it doesn't, because people are hungry for more and for more immersive, realistic feeling experiences. And whether it's football or African safari, 3D does deliver.
I think you're right. I mean, it seems to me that what's really going to drive it is both sports, which you mentioned mm-hmm. football, the World Cup, first mm-hmm. time in 3D. And these terrific nature films. I think of some of those great Discovery, mm-hmm. you know, Shark Week in 3D. Hey, that'd be fun with, you know, a bowl of popcorn.
And then there's other genres that we won't talk about in this conversation that are going to attract people. But the prices are coming down. We
don't necessarily have a family audience here. You can talk about what you like.
But we did an analysis, which is on our website, and it's really fascinating, and I'm going to continue to upgrade it, which looked at a classic Discovery-type crime show. And what it cost in 3D versus high def. And it's over nearly double. But it's coming down by the week, and there are new technologies and new processes that are going to bring it down where it's affordable, and people are going to pay a premium for it. So it'll work itself out.
Well, that is really fascinating. I think that's we're going to be looking forward to what you have to say about 3D, about this whole market for factual television. And I really would like to thank you for coming in. Peter Hamilton, documentarytelevision.com. Please, everybody, check it out. It really is a pleasure and incredibly informative. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, man.
You You've been listening to Max Media, a production of the Paley Center for Media in New York City. We're on the web at paleycenter.org. That's P-A-L-E-Y center.org. And you can reach us by email at maxmedia@paleycenter.org.